Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:48 p.m. the Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 13th. And I thought, and of course today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Friday the 13th has been not a great day for the bond markets, but as we can see here from the chart of JP Morgan, it is at a new all-time high and breaking out on a pretty dynamic move. We just think about the fact that back in 2009, the share was trading at close to about $17. Today, it's at 120 and change. And that's a pretty impressive advance relative to the rest of the financial sector. I think one of the more important points about the chart is to remember that JP Morgan is not only a domestic bank, but an international bank. And the fact that it is hitting new all-time highs, that does not suggest there's going to be a recession. That's despite the fact that that's what everybody is worrying about. So when, of course, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. So let's just consider what it's telling us, that the financial sector, at least the bigger parts of it, seem to be well insulated. And banks are generally lead indicators, although one has to then question whether that is going to remain the case in this cycle, because the credit extension and credit creation function that the banks normally fulfill in the economy has been largely subsumed by the Federal Reserve in terms of its quantitative easing programs. But also because, for example, in the mortgage sector, the vast majority of mortgages today are issued by non-bank lenders. Therefore, we would have to ask the question, and we will not have an answer for this question until we've actually seen a recession, but will the larger cap banks, particularly the investment banks, represent a lead indicator for trouble on this occasion in the same way that they did prior to the last recession, where they were the epicenter of risk? So perhaps that's the biggest conclusion, that the US banking sector today is not the epicenter of risk. They've been essentially de-risked. Their balance sheets have improved. They don't have the same kind of exposure to either the mortgage market or to egregious trading or lending standards because of the raft of additional regulations that they now have to contend with. The fact that compliance officers have made up the vast majority of new hires within the banking sector over the course of this bull market says a lot about just how much risk and whatever about appetite they might have, their ability to take on risk has been quite severely impinged. Well, then we should probably think about, well, what are the banking sectors of other countries doing? Well, the European Central Bank this week has announced quite a significant raft of additional measures. And the European banking sector, having trended downwards for over a year and a half, is at the lower side of this range that has persisted since at least 2012, and it's bouncing. It's right in the region of the trend mean right now. I think there are big questions, being asked about whether Europe adopting additional quantitative easing, moving further into negative deposit rates, but there is the additional point that they have announced a tiered rate for the banking sector, which is certainly to be welcomed. It's now testing the sequence of lower rally highs. If it breaks it, well, then that does suggest that we are going to see additional upside for the European banking sector. It looks completely different to the US banking sector, and therefore we would have to say that there is a candidate in Europe for European banks to offer a lead indicator for their respective market. And of course, that underperformance has been a lead indicator for the pressure that has come to bear on the Eurozone's economy over the course of the last 18 months, the fact that Germany is flirting with recession, and you have politicians quite clearly saying, well, we don't think we're going to have to engage in fiscal stimulus. The market is saying something else entirely. There is this competition going on right now for who can be the biggest fiscal conservative in a number of the creditor nations. And then, of course, you have this political discussion going on in France, where you have some people talking about fiscal conservatism, regardless of the fact that France has been one of the biggest sinners in terms of breaking its commitment to fiscal austerity. You have the fact that Miss Lagarde is going to be taking over the ECB, but she's not an economist. There is a competition going on to try and influence her. There is a competition going on to try and reshape the political environment within the EU between the interests of the debtors and the creditors. All of this is going on in the background. When we look at the value of the euro, it has been rallying over the last couple of days. It has not yet broken its downtrend. The last thing Europe wants is a strong currency. One thing that I think is particularly important about what's going on in Europe is that it does these big discussions that are going on do have the real potential to cause a significant problem. And regardless of the political statements that are being made at the moment, the reality is that the ECB has to be managed for the interests of the entire Eurozone bloc. The fact that the governments cannot get their act together and adopt any form of fiscal stimulus is an additional point. So, therefore, the ECB has to engage in additional stimulus. What we do know is that a 20 billion euro purchase program every month for the foreseeable future is considerably less than the kind of stimulus that was required, or at least implemented, from 2014 and a half onwards. When we think about the fact that monetary policy beats more of the fact most other factors most of the time, well, the ECB adopting additional stimulus, the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates, the fact that banks are responding, that's all rather positive. Even when we think about the Japanese banks, where they have been trending downwards as well for the last 18 months. They're also in the region of lows put in 2016. And the rally that we've seen so in here this week has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It's right in the region of the trend mean. If it can follow through on the upside next week, well, then we can very conclusively say that the downtrend has been broken. The Nikkei has also, it's one of the few indices that has broken its sequence of lower rally highs, and Europe hasn't quite managed to do that yet, but the Nikkei is now confirming at least near-term significance in the region of the trend mean. I think the longer-term chart for the Nikkei is particularly instructive, because the primary consistency characteristic of this trend has been that every time it got up to 20,000, all the way from 1993 onwards, it failed. And when it broke successfully above that level in 2017, it has now offered support. This range continues to look like a first step above the base. When we look at the second section index, it has not quite yet broken its sequence of lower rally highs, but it was in positive territory in here today. There is the potential here that Japan is going to be able to push onwards and upwards from these levels. Then I think we can conclude that there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence that it is going to be Japan is going to be the epicenter of risk either. Where is the epicenter of risk, therefore? Well, let's think about China. The A-share banks index has bounced in here today. These are all state-owned banks. The regional banking sector in China is not really performing, but we can't monitor it either. When we think about some of the rather large but certainly listed regional banks, Mingxiong comes to mind. There has been a very pronounced downtrend in that share since 2015, but even here it is starting to steady. China has not been as aggressive on the stimulus front on this particular occasion. They don't want to inflate its property bubble further. China does have a property bubble. They also have liar loans, although perhaps not so much in the mortgage sector, but certainly within the corporate sector. There is a significant quantity of US dollar denominated debt that the corporate sector has built up and the regional banks have built up. It went from virtually nothing to over $500 billion in the space of about 18 months before they tried to clamp down on the shadow banking sector. But they are still issuing dollar loans. What was particularly interesting in here this week was one of the rafts of measures that the Chinese introduced was to remove the limits on the QFII institutional investment programs. Institutional investors can now buy as many mainland assets as they like, but they hadn't been meeting the previous quotas. So it's a largely face-saving exercise, or it is a meaningless move. But the one point, of course, is that China never wanted anyone to invest in their banking sector when it was still expanding and very healthy. Now they're attempting to gain insurance by expanding international institutional investment in their banking sector when it is well past its peak. Therefore, I think if we're looking for candidates for where the epicenter of risk lies, it's in China. The problem for Europe is that it is really very heavily tied to China, and I think that's a rather important point. Then we should think about the renminbi. It has been strengthening over the course of the last couple of weeks. This is at least potentially pricing in the speculation, I think would probably be the best way to term it, that the trade war is nearing a truce at least. When we think about where are we in terms of this cycle, it does look like we are approaching a rather important juncture here. The S&P 500 has had three 18-month consolidations over the course of this bull market. This is another 18-month consolidation, and it has had an upward bias for most of this year. We're within just a couple of points of it hitting a new all-time high. The question I think investors are asking is whether it is ready to do it right away or whether it needs to have some additional consolidation following the impressive rebound from the lows in August. But it still looks like a bullish consolidation. And the Federal Reserve has demonstrated that not only are they talking, but that they're willing to act in order to sustain the economic expansion. We also have to consider that there is a presidential cycle underway. The third year of the US presidential cycle generally has a growth scare in the first half of the year, and we've had that. Then the Federal Reserve starts to ease policy, and we are getting that now. And it's usually in the second half of the year that the market starts to pick up. Well, the market hit a low in the region of the moving average in early June, and it has been up reasonably significantly since then. That suggests that this presidential cycle is following the set measure. Generally speaking, the fourth year of the US presidential cycle is the best performer. Now, when we think about the fact that the US government have agreed an additional 1.2 trillion stimulus, or call it fiscal spending, between now and January of 2020, that the Federal Reserve is cutting interest rates, that the ECB is engaging in additional quantitative easing, that the Bank of Japan has never really stopped, but they have slowed down in terms of their easing, but that countries, for example, like Australia, are engaging in both monetary and fiscal stimulus simultaneously. That has taken a toll on the Australian dollar, although it is rallying over the course of the last 2 weeks. But the broader perspective is that countries the world over are cutting interest rates. Everybody understands that we have had a 10-year bull market, that there has been some examples of silly lending standards. The fact that we've had low interest rates for a prolonged period of time, that has weighed on the value of savings. In fact, it has really been robbing savers who were relying on an interest rate. It has created a perverse incentive to invest in highly risky enterprises. Well, on the one hand, you have companies like Tesla, which have been able to revolutionize the automotive sector. I think it's unlikely that Tesla would ever have had an opportunity to get going were it not for record low interest rates. They announced this week that they have got the battery chemistry ready for a car battery that could keep going for 1 million miles without a great deal of loss of its charging capacity. That's an incredible breakthrough. It's one of the biggest arguments against buying an electric vehicle today is that they become pretty much worthless after about 5 years, in much the same way that phone batteries don't last as long after a couple of hundred recharges. It's the same thing with cars, so that the battery would need to be swapped out after a few years. That's in fact one of the primary arguments against the evolution of electric vehicles, that there isn't a recycling infrastructure and the cost of recycling the batteries is so high. But if Tesla's battery is in fact commercial, then this recycling argument disappears. A car that can drive 1 million miles, you're not going to have to worry about the battery degrading or needing to be recycled for years. A car like that could last for 20 or 30 years based upon a 10,000 mile a year life. Of course, that's not what they're thinking. What they're really thinking about is that they want to produce cars that are fully autonomous, that they will be driving day and night, and that they will be racking up hundreds of thousands of miles a year. That's one of the primary arguments behind developing these kinds of technologies. But it's a massive game changer in terms of the outlook for these markets. It probably would never have happened if we didn't have incredibly low interest rates for such a long time. Well, of course, the other problem is when we think about WeWork. WeWork is a company that has been renting office space and then subletting it. And they're doing that at a time when commercial real estate is at some of the highest rates ever. And they're renting space in some of the most expensive cities in the world. Well, that kind of loss-making enterprise and the grab for market share also probably would never have been possible if it were not for extraordinarily low interest rates. And I think there is some support for that view based upon the prior performance of a company like IWG. I've worked in some of these offices, and there was nothing impressive about them. This was a low capacity or a low capital intensive type of operation. They only expanded based upon the cash flow that they could generate, and therefore their growth was very slow. It's had a phenomenal run this year because it has been the listed proxy for people speculating in WeWork. But the bigger picture, one of the, and I think where we do have evidence of egregious trading and value and valuation expansion is within the private sector. There has been an IPO almost every day this week. And WeWork will be going for an IPO. They've already had a haircut from a valuation of $47 billion down to $20 billion, and when it eventually IPOs, it may be even lower than that. When we think about Uber, it's a company that its entire business model is, I think, largely based upon the hope that they will be able to get to autonomous vehicles before they run out of money. And it's looking extraordinarily unlikely that it will be Uber gets to the autonomous vehicle prize first. This is another company that could never have been sustained were it not for a massive move in terms of the availability of credit. The Peloton IPO is coming up in the next week or two, and this is a company that produces $4,000 exercise pieces of machinery, which are virtually useless unless you pay them $40 a month to engage with their classes. Well, you can go to LA Fitness for $40 a month and go to live classes, so why on earth you would want to spend $4,000 for a piece of exercise equipment is just beyond my comprehension. But this is going to be a billion-dollar IPO. Then when we think about, for example, Cloudflare, they IPO'd in here today. And this is a company that is at least has a business. They were up about $3 off the IPO, but not able to hold on to its initial advance and closing pretty much on the open. Well, now the question is whether it's going to do better than that. The problem with IPOs at the moment is that they're getting a very frosty reception. The one thing that IPOs do, however, is that they increase supply. When we think about where are we in terms of the cycle, then the efforts by private equity investors, particularly those that have made money by being early investors and now seeking an exit, they're raising cash at these levels. They're selling into a market that they were hoping would be a more lucrative environment for IPOs. The fact that WeWork were talking about shelving their IPO earlier on this week and came out yesterday with a rejig of their board, that does nothing to improve the financial situation of the company. And the only possible way that the company will persist is if they have continued access to additional revenues. When we think about Netflix, it's exactly the same story. This is a company that has got an ongoing capital commitment. They need additional capital in the order of tens of billions of dollars a year to continue to pump out what is effectively mediocre programming, and the competition in the sector that they pioneered is starting to increase. The one problem for companies like this is they don't have the moat. They don't have a really clear rationale for why their exact business model can't be copied. And with Apple announcing their Apple TV service to be released before the end of the year with a price tag of $4.99, then they're also getting price competition. And then Disney is also coming through with price competition versus Netflix. The only reason that Netflix has been able to justify the price that it's trading at has been because they've been raising prices. But the days of Netflix raising prices are over. Therefore, this also represents one of the epicenters of risk. So when we start to think about where are the risks in this market, then we can draw a very clear line through the kinds of companies that have benefited from a massive supply of capital over the course of this decade. If we're thinking about those that are going to do worst in a bear market environment, it's going to be those companies that have no profits and have got really quite spectacular valuations. I think one share that was particularly interesting in here today, or in here this week, was Shopify. And Shopify has been the best performing share among the IPOs, or I guess among the momentum shares this year. And it was up and down over the last few days, but it was down another $18 in here today. And this is a company where I've used it, and it allows you to create a website and get up and running on e-commerce in a really very short period of time. But it's trading on an estimated PE of 552, and they announced this week that their new strategy for growth is to go into warehousing. Well, the kind of business they were engaged in was very low footprint, having software that allowed people to create websites and give them an e-commerce platform is not particularly capital intensive. Going out and buying a robotics company and then leasing warehouses is much more capital intensive. It's an add-on business to the growth of creating websites. But what it also suggests is that they don't anticipate the growth of the websites business going that it's going to grow as quickly. This looks like a potential real problem. This is the kind of company that could pull back and pull back very, very aggressively. So these are the kinds of companies that do represent risk in this kind of environment. If we are, however, going to have additional monetary easing, well, then that is going to start to put pressure on bond markets because it represents additional supply. One of the most important points about the bond markets in here right now is that there is a slug of additional new supply coming to the market between now and the end of the year. The $1 trillion deficits that the US government is running, the $1.2 trillion in additional spending permissioned for between now and the end of 2020, in tandem with the ongoing refinancing of existing debt, that suggests that we have seen the low in terms of the yield. The kind of upper dynamic that we've seen in here today, or excuse me, in here this week, is in fact larger than every other dynamic we've seen from the lows that have been posted over the course of the last decade. This is about as clear a sign as one could possibly wish for that the lows in yields are in and the high for prices is in. The commonality that we're seeing in terms of the bond markets is global in nature. So we're seeing exactly the same thing in terms of the Bund, and there was a meaningful contract change in here this week. When we look at I'm looking for, yes, the Swiss government bond, which had also been at negative yields. It has had a very meaningful pullback over the course of the last 2 weeks. When we look at the JGBs, then they have also experienced a meaningful pullback, the biggest downward dynamics we've seen in really quite some time. Then let's look at the total return on US bonds, and it has been contracting aggressively over the course of this week. That's the biggest downward dynamic we've seen in at least the last year. And it is suggesting that at the very minimum, that the overextension relative to the trend mean is going to be unwound. And at least that there is the potential that this is the top in terms of the medium-term move that we've seen in term in the bond markets. There's even the potential that it is the top in terms of the long-term bull market in bonds. And these are meaningful developments. The fact that a lot of what has passed for monetary policy over the last decade has been covered by the fact that we've had a secular bull market in bonds going on. What we're now starting to see is that the bond auctions for the German government and the US government have been failing. That appetite for bonds at these incredibly low yields, against a background of rising deficits, particularly in the USA, will not continue to be tolerated. If bonds are selling off in such an aggressive manner, then that is something that is going to release capital. People will start selling, they'll be raising cash. And we have to ask, where is the cash going to be going to find a home? Well, the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index was at a new high in here this week, and it was in mildly negative territory in here today. But this has been a very impressive range that's formed over the course of the second half of this year, or at least over the last 6 months. It would at least need to sustain a move below the trend mean to question potential for additional upside. Then we have the Russell 2000. It is right in the region of its peaks for the year, and it has been up in a dynamic manner in here this week. Upside follow-through next week would confirm a return to demand dominance. We have had a very significant pullback, a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It is quite normal to have a period of right-hand extension following that kind of move. So it isn't simply wouldn't it wouldn't be just convenient for the Russell 2000 to push through that 1600 point level. It is in fact necessary to unwind the scope that this is not a type 2 top with right-hand extension. So we are at an important juncture in terms of these markets. It's quite uncanny that the transportation sector has got a very similar pattern, and it is also testing its previous peaks. Then, when we go back and think about what is going on in terms of the banking sector, then it's also really quite similar. So it's important that these indices do push higher. Now, the one unifying characteristic that they all have is that they are cyclical in nature, and it is quite normal that cyclicals should do better in the latter stages of a bull market. One of the most cyclical sectors are commodities, and the Continuous Commodity Index has been trending downwards since the second quarter of 2018. It's now testing its sequence of lower rally highs. Of course, commodities have been heavily influenced by the trade war. What we definitely saw in here this week was some effort to try and moderate the rhetoric surrounding the trade war. Whether that is eventually going to result in a deal of some form, I think, is rather debatable. But the one thing that we have to consider is that President Trump wants to get re-elected. It's going to be difficult to be re-elected if there's a recession between now and November 2020. He therefore has an incentive to put the trade war on ice, and There is the potential that that might be on the cards. He's going to need something to walk away with, and so is China. But when we look at what's going on in terms of the agricultural commodities, lean hogs had a very clear upside weekly key and has continued to hold its sequence of higher reaction lows in here this week. Soybeans is also firming and has put in a higher reaction low. When we think about what's going on in terms of the cotton price, it has bounced from the lows put in all the way back in 2016. Then copper, which is very heavily dependent on China, has rebounded from the $2.50 area. Now, that has at least pushed back up towards the trend mean, and this has been a meaningful bounce. So that at least should give some confidence that things are starting to turn around. And palladium, which is heavily influenced by the automotive market, is at a new all-time high in here this week. When we look at the performance of the cyclicals, and we gel that with the fact that the central banks of the world are starting to ease policy, then that does suggest that there is scope for additional upside. What we would anticipate is that the shares and assets that did best from the low interest rate environment and abundant liquidity environment would start, if they led on the upside, then they should start to lead on the downside. And we are, in fact, starting to see that. When we started to see the banks underperforming was all the way back in 2006. The wider market didn't peak until 2008. When we get an inverted yield curve, I think the two most important lessons from the yield curve are that it offers a very long lead in terms of its prediction for a recession. Then the market generally tends to rally in the months after the inversion, and it isn't really until we start to see the yield curve spread surging higher that we really need to worry urgently about a recession. That is worth just going back and thinking that the first time it became inverted was in February of 2006. The wider market didn't really run into trouble until the yield curve spread had gone all the way back up towards 200 basis points right at the beginning of 2018. So when we look at the lead indicator, this is exactly when people start to worry about a recession. Generally speaking, after they start worrying about it, the market breaks upwards and they forget about it again. But the lead indicator has already occurred. By the time it gets around to a bubbly condition where markets have been doing phenomenally well for a year, people have forgotten about the lead indicator, and that's when people are more invested. One thing that I'm particularly conscious of is that there is a lot of money on the sidelines. The quantity of money that is sitting in money market funds is in the region of approximately $3 trillion. That does suggest that there is scope for some support to start coming through in this market. When we look at the things that are doing well, bond proxies are now starting to underperform. So Visa, for example, had an upside, or excuse me, had a downside key reversal on Monday, and it does look at risk of pulling back. American Tower, which has been one of the most successful IPOs in history, has also pulled back really very violently. The reliability of the company's cash flows are what helped to sustain this phenomenal move over the course of the last decade, but its yield has now compressed to about 1.6%, even though its dividend growth rate is in the order of 20%. And that does suggest that we're going to see some mean reversion going on. But then when we think about What are the shares that are starting to do better? Well, it's in the transportation sector, it's in the banking sector, and in the insurance sector, where they should be picking up a bid in terms of the value of their holdings. Well, Berkshire Hathaway has been going sideways now for about a year and a half, and it was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. If the kind of cyclicals that it owns, where it has got large positions in railroads, in banks, and in insurance companies, then those are all the kinds of assets that do well in an environment where cyclicals are starting to catch a bid. Higher yields are generally suggesting that there is more risk appetite. And if there is more risk appetite, then people will start looking for bargains. The likelihood is that we are moving into a bubbly kind of environment. We know that valuations are already at perhaps not at bubble valuations, but they're pretty high already. If we see markets breaking out, then earnings are going to have to keep pace or accelerate if we're not going to see valuation expansion. I think it's quite likely we are going to see valuation expansion because we are moving back into an additional quantitative easing period of time. That does raise questions about the short term and the medium term outlook for gold. The total of bonds with negative yields hit 17 trillion at the end of August. It's at about 14.5 trillion at the moment. The fact that gold peaked or hit $1,550 first at the end of August and has since contracted, that does suggest that part of the reason why gold was able to rally was because so many other assets on a relative basis had a negative yield, and therefore gold was looking positive by comparison. That suggests that we are now in the period where we can anticipate that gold will form a first step above the base. And what I find particularly interesting is this is almost an identical replay of the environment that persisted in 1999 through to 2002. And I highlight this because it's eerily similar. We had a very pronounced pop on the upside in 1999, just like we had with the big move in 2016. It took approximately 2 years, 2.5 years, to range, and then it succeeded in taking out the peak from 1999. Well, it took almost 3 years for the peak in 2016 to be superseded. Then we had a meaningful breakout, and the size of the breakout was about 18%. And the size of the breakout we've just had in gold was about 17%. On that occasion, we had a pullback all the way to the peak put in back in 1999. And it was after that that the bull market really got started. Well, if we're then thinking about what could happen in terms of gold, it is not at all beyond the bounds possibility that we could have the gold price coming all the way back down and testing the $1,350 area. That would be the upper side of the range. One thing we know about trading gold over the course of the last decade and more, in fact, since we're in 2019 and I started working with David in November of 2003. It feels it's a darn sight longer than a decade. But one thing we know is that gold is a volatile asset. We also know that it tends to overshoot on both the upside and the downside. And we are now potentially in a period where we're going to get a first step above the base. This reaction is larger than any reaction we've seen since the firming in June of this year. So, there is a clear risk here that we're going to get a more volatile environment in gold, and there is potential now that silver is starting to lead. It definitely did not lead on the upside, but it may be leading on the downside, and it really took it on the chin in here today, down 64 cents. This is by far the largest pullback we've seen in at least the last few months. It is confirming near-term resistance in the region of $20. It's unwinding the short-term overbought condition. The true measure of whether we're back in a demand-dominated environment will be the extent to which it can find support in the region of the trend mean. And platinum got all the way up to test the $1,000 area, and now it is also easing back from that level. It did not rally to nearly the same extent as gold or silver, so it perhaps does not have as far to fall, but so far there is no evidence that this pullback has ended. That's the short-term view. But we know what the attitude of central banks is. We know what the attitude of governments is. They are willing to do anything to try and sustain the current economic expansion because they're terrified of the next recession. Their conventional playbook will be to lower interest rates, but they're already close to the zero bound. Their conventional playbook would be to re-engage with quantitative easing, but the quantity of money that needs to be printed in order to get the same bang for their buck when they have already been through three successive rounds of quantitative easing is a very large figure, and they may not have the appetite for that. And that opens up the potential for even more extraordinary policies. And they perhaps don't yet have the stomach to really engage with those. So that suggests that we are going to see more money printed first, because what central banks are doing today is they are anticipating financial or economic statistic deterioration. They're not waiting for the economic statistics. They're as aware as anyone else that those economic statistics on which they base their decisions are lagging, and there is a lagged response in terms of monetary easing in the economy. So they're acting first. They're anticipating that they will get a deterioration in their economic statistics, and now they're already cutting interest rates. And that suggests that we are going to see additional upside. We're going to see valuations expand. And there is therefore the possibility that when they eventually do start to experience inflation, and there is a logical reason why that might be the case. We're starting to see commodity prices doing better. We're also starting to see some of the effects of the trade war starting to filter through into prices. So imports are getting more expensive. I think the linchpin in terms of inflation is the dollar. And the dollar was in negative territory in here today. So far, over the course of the last year and a bit, it has done not much of anything. And if the dollar were to break its uptrend, and there is not a great deal of evidence to say that it's going to do that just yet, then that would unleash an inflationary problem. So there is the scope for inflation to start to increase, because we are already at a period where cyclicals should start to do better. The fact that the Baltic Dry Index has broken on the upside and completed a decade-long base formation is also supportive of the view that shipping prices are already starting to rise. The missing ingredient in terms of an inflationary argument is the fact that oil prices remain contained. And the oil price today was in mildly negative territory, but I think it is quite clear from the weekly chart that there has been a sequence of lower rally highs since the end of 2018, and it remains in place. On the other hand, if oil prices were to start rallying up and through that 200-day moving average, well, then that would be a different story. That would immediately start to add inflationary pressures. So we are at a period where there is a lot of uncertainty, there is a lot of cash on the sidelines, and markets have been steady throughout. I think part of the reason why the market has been steady over the course of the last 6 months in terms of the equity markets has been because investors have been willing to price in the potential that there will be a resolution in the short term to the trade war. The problem is when you start to look at the long term, it does not look that promising. It is quite likely that the trade war is a secular phenomenon, that it is that the increasing competition between the USA and China is something that is going to persist virtually indefinitely, and it will eventually climax either in the collapse of one of or both of the economies or a war to settle their differences. When we think about what are the things that could really put a hole in the secular bull market hypothesis, then that is something that could really puncture it. That's not a near-term consideration, but it is a longer-term consideration. The trade war is likely to ebb and flow because the unwinding of the interconnectedness of the US and the Chinese economies is not going to, it just takes more time, I think is probably the best way to think about it. It can't be done in the space of 6 months or a year. But we also know that China now has a clear intention at self-sufficiency in the technology sector, and most particularly in the newer side of the technology sector. In fact, they have to generate massive value creation from investing in technology to try and pick up the slack from the end of their infrastructure boom. So it is a needs must argument for China. They don't have a choice in the matter. And they have got the clearest risk of an economic collapse because of the leverage and bubble they have in their own property markets. If we are really thinking about a new Cold War, and I think that that is perhaps the best way to think about it, well, we know how the last one ended. It ended with the collapse of the USSR's economy. That is quite likely to be the end aim of the trade war, is to create an economic collapse in China in order to usher in a new government which is potentially more friendly. And there is the real potential that that is the case. Then, of course, we have the point that the USA is now the biggest oil exporter in the world. It's also a significant exporter of natural gas. So it does not have the same dependency on the Middle East or the same need to support the freedom of shipping in the Middle East. Other than that, as a major exporter, they have as much an interest in ensuring that there is a stable market for their exports as any other exporter does. Then, when we think about how to invest over the medium term, the clearest move is likely to be on the upside in terms of stock markets over the course of at least the next year. I do think we're still in a secular bull market, and when we think about the Dow Gold ratio, then it has had a rather significant move over the course of this last few months, where the gold price had rallied really rather spectacularly, but now we're starting to see the equity market starting to do better again. When we look at it over the very long term, there have been periods when gold did better. There have been periods when equities did better. The move that we've had in the last while has been certainly a trend in consistency in terms of the outperformance of the stock market. I do think that with the outlook over the medium term for competitive currency devaluation, then the best assets to be in are either going to be hard assets like gold or the kinds of assets that have got connections to real-world businesses, which are equities. That suggests that we could have a rangy environment in terms of the Dow Gold ratio rather than a clear outperformance of one over the other for the next while. But there is the potential that if equities continue to move higher, that they can drag gold with them. The real scope for governments to engage in extraordinary monetary policy is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility. The most likely scenarios that will contribute to competitive currency devaluation, that is bullish for gold over the medium term. It suggests that what's going on in gold right now is a reversion to the mean. It is probably going to be a first step above the base. We will not have confirmation of that until we have absolute confirmation of gold finding support. We don't have that just yet. This is, however, the part of the cycle where gold shares do tend to outperform. So there is the scope for gold shares to pull back while gold is weak, but they do have the potential to do better when gold starts to rally once more. I think the most likely scenario is that we're going to get a breakout on Wall Street, which will lead to additional enthusiasm for stock markets over the next while. The prognostications that have been circulating over the summer about an impending doom and gloom, I think are premature. There is a much more likely scenario that we're going to enter a bubble phase, and the hardest thing to do then will be to remain or to retain an emotional equilibrium. But we have that in front of us. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.